everyone, and welcome back to the 16mm Film Crew. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Dale.
You can watch us on YouTube. You can like and comment on our YouTube videos and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can listen to us everywhere podcasts are found at 16mm Film Crew Podcast. Leave us a rate and review. And visit us on our website at www.16mmfilmcrew.com. This week, we watched Perfect Days, directed by Wim Wenders. Here's your synopsis. Hirayama feels content with his life as a toilet cleaner in Tokyo. Outside of his structured routine, he cherishes music on cassette tapes, reading books, and taking photos. Through unexpected encounters, he reflects on finding beauty in the world. And this film stars Koji Yakusha. So, Dale, take it away.
Yeah, it's like I said, we're doing our Oscar review. This is one of the few international films that I kind of had an opportunity to watch this year. And I don't know, I enjoyed it, the simplicity of it, you know. And it's a real, the story of this man is kind of like a drastic contrast to how capitalistic cultural society works. You see it evident in the fact he's working in Tokyo and everybody around him is hustling, bustling in suits. You know, his sister comes, chauffeured. You know, apparently he comes from a privileged background because they talk about their father and stuff like that. And he's like, he's contented with what he's at. I feel like that's the dream for a lot of people. I know that's just a dream for me. Like, if people's like, whenever social media says, oh, what would you do if you won X amount of money? I was like, if I want to be like everybody else, I'd say, yes, I want the million, I want this. But then, realistically, I just want to be happy. I want enough money to, you know, I could travel when I want to, you know, a couple times a year. My bills are paid, and I'm content. And I think that's the overall dream for everybody. And I think that's also why this resonated with so many judges and voters for the international film community.
Yeah. I thought that this movie was really sweet. It was long.
Yeah.
It was very long. And I have talked about how I feel about lengths of films plenty of times on this podcast. And normally I don't mind it. Honestly, like, this kind of reminded me a little bit of Drive My Car, just in terms of like you're seeing someone's routine kind of over and over and over again. Like, that is kind of the movie. But because this was much more pared down, because he lives a very simplistic life, it did feel like a true, true slow burn, like a real, like, we're slowing everything down for this one. And they did. They did that. Other than that, though, I did think this movie was really good. I thought that, I think it's Yoshi. I might be pronouncing that wrong. But the main character, I felt like he was so good in this. Like, his performance was amazing, just because, like, he is a man of very little words in this movie, and so everything is facial expressions, body motions, just like all of that. And at first I thought it was like a silent film or something, like, or like a semi-silent film where he was just like wasn't gonna talk at all. And I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. But he does talk. It's just like very minimal. Very minimal dialogue. And his perspective on the world, I just thought was really nice in terms of just like valuing nature and music and books and stuff like that resonated with me. Like, I felt that deeply. His very like basic way of how he lives his life was very, yeah, it's almost kind of inspiring, because it's like, oh, well, you know, I don't know what I would honestly do without the internet, to be honest. Like, I don't know if I could take it that far, but I did like how he did seem to be like more connected with his community in terms of like going to the same spots every time, like every day, and people knowing who he is, and have like, even though he didn't really interact with people all the time, like he wasn't engaged in conversation with people, he was always around people. So like when he goes to the different restaurants, when he goes to like the shower house or something like that, like he is with people and he really enjoys people and like likes them, even though he doesn't interact with them. And so I was thinking, like, is he happy in terms of like his structure of how he can be in control of his life you know, he knows what his job is. He knows how to do it really well. He cares about his job, even though it might be something that most people look down on. He puts a lot of value into it. And is there a part of him that maybe is missing, like, social connection? Like, whenever he is with people, like when he's with his niece, when he's with the owner of the restaurant's ex-husband, like, he seems to really be so happy and almost like he's deprived of, like, that intimate connection. And I feel like what would have made his life perfect is if he, like, not had, like, a person, but, like, had people, like a support group or something like that, to be with him on his journey. I feel like that would have made his life amazing, because it does feel like he is longing for it. Like, the longer you watch the movie, it feels like there is, like, a longing for deeper connection. So
yeah, I enjoy the fact that, like, a key component of his day-to-day routine is reading and thinking about the authors he picked, you know, William Faulkner, Patricia Highsmith, and Aya Coda. It's kind of funny that those authors are represented in this project, because this movie kind of does delve into those themes a lot of these authors wrote with. You know, Faulkner is known for being a very emotional, kind of subtle writer, which kind of fits with this movie. This movie is, like, really emotional, but also very, very subtle. You have Patricia Highsmith, known for writing The Talented Mr. Ripley. Her projects deal with a lot of depression, you know, anxiety. And you can see that when he's emoting, when he's listening to music, and how he sometimes looks at people and he engages, interacts. Like, a twinge of, like you said, he engages people, but not 100%. There's a twinge of loneliness. And she also writes a lot about the pessimistic and stuff like that. You know, in Aya Coda, she talks about family relations and traditional culture. You see that when they're talking about when his niece enters the story, you know, his sister, talk about their father. And you also see the clash of culture as far as the generational. You know, his co-worker, very young, doesn't really care about doing the work. He's like, I just need to get this money so I can spend this on my girlfriend and we can go on our date. Even to the point where he's like, oh, you have a lot of these old seat records. Let's sell them so I can go impress my girlfriend. Stuff like that. Like, I like the fact that they highlighted those authors, and this picture integrates elements of those authors in this project.
Yeah, the books were, like, a huge part of this movie, and the music was a huge part of this movie. Like, that was my favorite part of this film, was the music, was, like, and the music choices, like Lou Reed, The Velvet Underground, Nina Simone. Like, he has great taste. Yeah. This man has great taste in literature and music. Like, he's good. So I trust him. I would trust him to DJ, you know, I would trust him with the aux in the car, you know, I feel like he has it, because the music was so great, especially that ending scene was perfect. Like, that was a perfect song to match the emotional moment that was happening. But honestly, I felt like all of the music choices, like where they were slotted in, was just completely aided in the storytelling. And I feel like a lot of times and I feel like we talked about this before, when you have a soundtrack that, like, where it's like very notable songs, sometimes it can kind of just feel like needle drops. Like, okay, well, this is a song that we think the audience will know, so we'll play that. And I think when you have something like that, it really does have to aid in the story that you're telling, or else it's just like music as fan service kind of. So I thought that all the choices were great, because it really highlights, like, where he is in his emotional journey. And so they weren't just, like, there to be there. Like, they actually had a purpose in the story, which was really good.
Like it's like people forget music, especially in movies, like, they're characters as well. You know, they're basically, and people we do it in real life. Like, we listen to songs based on how we're feeling. Like, everybody has their own internal soundtrack of certain songs, the way they're feeling. Like, I have, like, multiple playlists of different moods. Like, I'm in this mood, I'm gonna play this because I vibe with it, or because I'm in this mood, I'm gonna play a different song or different playlist to get me out of that mood. Like, everybody has that, and I think this movie encapsulated it perfectly. Like you said, we're not doing needle drops for the sake of doing needle drops. Same thing with, like, the settings. Like, settings is a characteristic. Like, you see when he interacts with certain people, like when he goes to the bathhouse, it's usually just him and the old guys. You know, he doesn't really socialize. He's just in and out. Or when he goes to the bar after work, everybody there is heck talking, hanging out. He just, you know, goes, eats some sushi, drinks some water, and, like, leaves. Like, the city and everything else is another character. And it's also showcasing his attachment and also detachment with these different aspects of society.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I felt like Tokyo was very much like, and it's interesting because it's like how the city is depicted. Some of it looks really beautiful. Some of it looks, you know, a little run down. But I think that the fact that he always goes to the park and he always like goes to sit by the trees and takes pictures of the trees, it's kind of like this back and forth of like the, I guess, the capitalistic kind of hustle muscle, like you were saying, of the city compared to the nature and how much he values like being with nature. He like takes a little root, like a little tree, and like is growing it, and he grows like plants in his house and stuff. Like, it's the back and forth of like you said, of like being attached to the city in a certain way and also wanting to kind of step beyond that and kind of live in the natural. So it's very, it is very back and forth, and I like that. I like that how they kind of depicted both of those things and how like it does feed into who you are, because if you're around that every day, like it is going to impact you. So I thought that was interesting.
Like, I think my favorite part though of this movie though was when the niece came and he goes into the spare room. And we see, like, for the most time we're in his house, we see his bedroom, you know, he has a bookshelf, his Tammy mat to sleep on, you know, a hook to put his jumpsuit on, and a book, and a lamp to read his books. And then the other room, he just has a coffee table with the trees, with the saplings. But once he goes to the spare room, you see he has a lot of furniture, and he does not use it. Like, he just completely isolates himself from all his other, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? All of the crap in his house. It focuses on his, like, necessities, my trees and my bed to sleep on. And that's really it. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. That's also my favorite part, too, is when the niece comes in. Because I feel like that's when the story kind of picks up a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I liked her interruption into his life. Only just because it's, like, now you're faced with, like, a different type of personality, different energy, you know, someone. And I thought the character was really sweet, Nico, just because like she wanted to like help him out at work and stuff, and she wanted to like be involved in his life, which I thought was really amazing. And how even though she ran away for the first time, like she always wanted to just go to his house, which was like so cute. But also the conversation that they have were really, I think, exposing of how he understands the world. Like, I love when they're in the car and she's like, can I get this song on my phone? Is it on Spotify? And he was like, oh, where is Spotify? Let's go there. It's like, it's on the internet, Gramps. I mean, uncle. So that was cute. But also when she's like, when she's talking about, I forgot exactly what brought up the conversation, but when he was like, you know, next time is next time. Like when he was like, kind of talking about more of his philosophy of like how he understands things, where it's like, I live in the present. And yeah, so whatever happens later. We'll talk about that later. But it does seem like when her mom comes to pick her up, there is a huge history there. Like just in their interactions as siblings, and also like that hug he gives her at the end when she's about to leave, and the look on her face, like, there's someone down back in those days. And I feel like maybe the way he lives his life now is a reaction to what had happened in his past. And maybe it's like a constant need to kind of move away from whatever happened back then. So yeah, I'm interested. I kind of want to know what happened. they never go into it, but yeah, I want to know.
Yeah. I think there was something there, especially if you're drawing from those authors, you know, Patricia Highsmith, you know, mm-hmm. talk about, she deals with depression, anxiety, all that stuff. Even the bookstore clerk mentioned all those things these writers write about. You know, Aya Kota talking about family issues like that. There is a lot of subtext that's there that we don't get. And sometimes sometimes less is more. I'm perfectly fine with them not delving into it because that's not really the whole focus of the picture. The focus of the picture is him. And you can kind of inference, it gives, like, the picture kind of gives you a blank slate to input your own feelings and your own experiences into it, which I think is, it's helpful that he doesn't talk most of the movies. So you get those scenes of isolation or where he's interacting with other people, well, interacting with other types of people. You can kind of infer based on your experiences in the situation and what he's probably thinking and compartmentalizing in his head.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like this is a very, because there is so much space, you do end up kind of feeling like you're kind of interjecting on this film. Like you feel like you're in it. Like you feel like you are a part of this journey somehow. So that is, I think that's actually really good. Makes a lot of sense. Is very smart. Because it makes the audience participants. Because, you know, you are projecting a lot of your own stuff into it. I mean, I wasn't fully sometimes, but like there were times where I was like, yeah, no, I relate to that. And I understand this. And I would like to be more like this in some ways. So, yeah, I definitely feel like it makes you culpable. Like it makes you a part of it. Somehow, which is a good thing.
Yeah, and I honestly, in reading about this project, like, I love the backstory of this movie so much. Like, this was, like, post-COVID, then restrictions are easing up internationally. Like, the director, Wim Wenders, was invited to Tokyo by one of the producers just to observe the Tokyo Toilet Project, which is what Kyo is employed by. And it was just, hey, we're redesigning a bunch of different public toilets. Cool. And he was there just, you know, basically do a short, you know, advertise before. And he was like, nah, I'm making a whole movie out of this. Just to take the idea of, hey, we know you're a famous, well-established, you know, German film director, you know, BAFTAs, Cannes, Venice. We just want a short film highlighting the uniqueness of this public works project. Just to highlight the uniqueness of these locations and the public facilities, and then to take it and go, no, I'm going to do a full-length feature picture is an amazing leap of creativity in my eyes. And the fact that this picture was shot over 17 days as well. So, yeah.
What? That's crazy. I love that, though. Yeah. I love that because that makes so much sense. But yeah, I really liked this film. One, I liked it because I like watching people's morning routines. So I was like, ooh, what you getting up to? What you eat for breakfast? But I also liked just how kind it felt. Like it didn't, like, there are movies that could be made where like maybe people were mean or maybe he was, the main character was embittered and whatever. Like, it's not like that at all. Like, he's just a really sweet man and everyone's really sweet. Like, the little tic-tac-toe game he plays with the mystery person in the bathroom, a little gross, not gonna lie, but overall sweet. I hope he washed his hands afterwards. But yeah, the ending scene for me was like the best part just because it's like, we don't know what will happen in the future as he's like, we're watching his, that kind of last shot of him going to work, which is something that we've watched, you know, over and over again throughout the movie, and the song and how his face looks happy. And then it looks a little sorrowful. And then it looks like it's like fluctuating in between so many different emotions and hopeful and also longing. It's just like really, again, the actor is amazing. Cause like he was able to depict all that. I think he won at Cannes for like best actor just because, yeah, that makes total sense. Like he was wonderful in this. And yeah, all of those emotions, I was just like, I feel like I have so much more to explore with this man, but this is like the last we're seeing of him in this movie. So I just thought that was really good because you do feel super attached to him by the end of it.
Yeah, I think the ending piece with Feeling Good playing in the background was perfect because it literally summarizes the picture in itself. Like, there are good days and there are bad days. And in those good days and bad days, you kind of mask and pretend you're feeling good when you're not feeling good. And then there are days where you're actually feeling good. And it, I think, like, and to me, it's kind of like, this movie resonates with me a lot because it's one of those things when, like, dealing with therapy and you have depression and stuff, they kind of tell you to get into a routine. And you see that he kind of has a consistent routine, but then you see those breaks of the veneer where life still kind of hits you, but he still recovers and he continues on. So, like, that whole mental, like, part of the movie and the use of those songs really, like, resonated with me a lot.
Yep, so highly encourage everyone to go watch it.
So, on to the complete opposite. You know, Oscar season just finished. You had Corey Jefferson talk about the issues in Black cinema and how there are a plethora of stories to tell. But there are also bad stories to tell. There's been reported recently that hit feature film American Society of Magical Negroes is on pace to only earn $1 million so far box office. And it, to me, in my opinion, I think people's reaction and interest in this movie from the initial, like, poster dropping to the trailers coming out, people's reaction changed to it. And it's clear that both Kobe, hopefully I pronounced his name correctly, Kobe Libby, the director, and also Justice Smith were, what's the word, ill prepared for the reaction that the picture was going to get. He kind of, like, this movie is called American Society of Magical Negroes because it's based on the trope, you know, coined by Spike Lee, but those kind of pictures really haven't been done in years. Like, the last one we saw, I think, was The Help, in a way, where, you know, but Justice Smith says, you know, part of this movie is about the promise of false assimilation. But based on the trailer, it doesn't really make that sense. It seems like Black guy gets magical powers, has a white person, falls in love with a white girl. But he says this movie is about passability, you know, people of color who look a certain way or dress a certain way, who are light-skinned like them to appease, are still not given a seat at the table. And the movie really does not communicate those opinions. And then the director himself even goes on to say he thinks white audiences will get a lot out of this. And he says it's very specifically a story about his experience as a Black person. This is director Kobe Libby. And he still calls it a universal film. And he also says because it's a personal story for him, that's why he also intentionally casted Justice Smith. So there's like a real lot of disconnect on what they were expecting from the project. I think one reviewer even mentions in the whole movie that there is a point where Justice, his character, there's no scenes that showcasing him having an actual community. Like, his work is basically, he looks at art installations dealing with yarn. You know, that's a void of zero personality. He has no community. He just meets David, Alan Grier's character, and he's thrust into a magical world. He's never had a sense of community before. And then near the end of the movie, he goes on a whole diatribe on what it is to be Black. It seems like Kobe is still trying to wrestle with a self-identity thing. And it's kind of executed poorly in this picture. So I don't know what either of them were expecting out of this project. Because it's clear that this movie was not made for Black people based on what the director said. But this is a kind of concept of Black people with magical powers that only Black people would be interested in watching. So I don't know what he thought was going to happen with this project or not, which is weird for me.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Yeah,
I saw this was gonna play at Sundance and I was like, oh, I want to watch it, but it was all sold out. And then when I was gonna go, I actually forgot when the release date was, And then you were like, no, I heard it's not good. So I was like, okay, well, I guess I don't have to pay attention to it anymore. And to hear that it not only came out, but it is doing very poorly, I was like, oh, okay, it's interesting. That's very interesting. But what you're saying is like, yeah, I've seen this a couple of times, not with Black people in particular, but just with like actors in general sometimes, where they think that they're doing, like they're signing up for one thing and then the movie comes out and it's not at all what they thought that they were doing, yeah. Which is like very scary because it takes a lot to make movies and, you know, a lot of time is spent making movies. So it's like, at what point did you not realize that the thing that you signed up for was not the thing that you were actually doing? Like, it took the film to be shot, edited, and then pushed out into the world for you to realize, like, oh, I thought we were making something and we weren't making that. So I don't know, from Justice's point of view, like, I kind of feel bad because I'm like, oh, maybe you thought that you were making one thing and then the film came out and it wasn't that, and I'm sorry. For the director, I think maybe he also thought that he was making one thing, but didn't execute any of the things that he was talking about.
Yeah.
And yes, if you make a movie that stars Black people that's about Black themes, but you're saying this is for white audiences, I don't think it's ever gonna...
It's not gonna work.
...go well. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it's gonna go well. Like, the movie... It's either it's specifically for the Black people, or you're saying it's universal, which means it's just for everyone. But yeah. But if you're making a movie about Black themes for white people, I just don't know how that's going to work out. I think people have tried to do that and it hasn't worked out.
Yeah, like he mentioned in another interview, like he was in like trying to reconcile he's been trying to massage this. These issues first came up from when the trailer came out. Mm-hmm. And so from it premiered at Sundance, he's been trying to like, no, it's X, Y, Z, it's this and this and this. He's trying to like mental gymnastics his way out of the audience reaction, which I can empathize completely. If I'm a creative and I put my heart and soul into a project and the reaction is negative across the board, I'm going to grasp at any straw I can to explain and reconcile as to why. And I think in one interview with inverse.com, like he kind of says like he was seeking safety in white discomfort or from white discomfort, which is a tricky topic to, you know, execute film wise especially if you're trying to target that movie to white people. No white person was going to go, yeah, let me get a ticket for American Society of Magical Negroes. Like, they're not ever going to say that. So I do feel like his expectations for this project exceeded a realistic point of view, you know? And this also being his directorial debut in a project, both writing and directing, it's a tough pill to swallow. But I think it's also a good lesson to learn as a creative. Like, certain topics aren't palatable for everybody. You have to know how to execute those topics. So.
Right. I think that's what it is. It's about the execution of it. Because I feel like we, white people, have come to difficult topics about racism and stuff in the past. Get Out, Black Panther, American Fiction. Like, we've seen how you can talk about difficult things when it comes to racism and Black experience. Like, we've seen how that can be done well. So I think that is just like how you go about it, because white people will watch it. It's just like, it's, I don't know. And maybe, like you said, it's his first film. So like, I think it is a learning lesson. Like, it's just maybe you were trying to be a little too ambitious in terms of like how you thought this was going to go. And maybe you just needed to, you know, be a little grounded and see where things unfolded from there. But, you know, I don't know. I don't want to hate on his creativity because like, no, he is telling his experience, but it's just like, unfortunately, it just doesn't seem like it registered with people.
Yeah. And it's like that. And I understand like, when him and Justice talk about the issues of palatability, especially in the Black community, it's a prevalent thing. You know, like lighter skinned black people and darker skinned black people. There is a whole issue in itself, and I applaud two light skinned black men for trying to tackle that issue.
Yeah.
But by having kind of a the issue in the movie wasn't the fact that Justice liked her, you know, a white woman. The issue was kind of, hey, you're a magical Negro. Your job is to help white people, what you love. It's weird. It's like a hard, it's a hard to tell that story of, you know, issues of in our own community of, you know, skin color and stuff like that. This is not the movie to kind of execute that concept. You know, yeah. That's all. Yeah.
All right, moving on to our next story. Civil War director Alex Garland blasts the incredibly dangerous political divide in an interview. So Civil War is a new A24 movie that's coming out, starring Kirsten Dunst, Nick Offerman, like a lot of really good actors. And Alex Garland, who did Ex Machina, Annihilation, one of my favorite directors. I'm going to ignore Men and pretend like I didn't see that. But for everything else, love his work. He is coming out with a new movie, Civil War, that it's about basically America having like a world war, not a world war, but like America going through like a second civil war in like a dystopian future that doesn't seem just so dystopian. Like it seems like it's very close to what could possibly happen in our own lives. And he was at South by Southwest and they were talking about this. Basically, like it seems that people have very mixed feelings about this movie. One, because it's about like America coming apart at the seams during an election year. Oh. And also because, are you okay?
No, I'm just laughing at the irony of that. You know, it's, wow, really?
Really? And just that it's too close to home. Like the timing of it is what people are having some issues with because they're like, why are you putting this out like right now? He made a lot of different comments about it. And I agreed with some of what he was saying. Some of what he was saying was like, you know, America isn't special in having a lot of these issues. Like it's happening all around the world, which is absolutely true. And that he was like, I wrote this during COVID and those issues were like in the middle of an election year. So like the issues are still the same. So like, why not talk about it now? Like it seems, and I completely agree with that. I feel like, honestly, if people see something that scares them, maybe they'll think again about staying home and not voting. Maybe they'll think again about like what's at stake. I feel like movies like this are a really good thing.
Yeah.
Especially during an election year where a lot of people are very apathetic about government and voting and all the other stuff. Maybe this will help motivate people. Like, I don't know. I'm not sure if it will do that or if it will purely be entertainment, but I'm happy that it exists and that it seems like it's good from the scores I saw. Like, I'm going to watch it. So I feel like these are the type of movies that need to come out. Like, if people keep thinking that art and politics are not synonymous, like, you don't understand cinema. Like, that is, film has always been political. So I feel like, yes, make it. He made some other comments about how like there are good people on both sides of the ideological spectrum. I disagree with that. I don't think that's true. I think that certain people and certain people's policies are actually extremely dangerous and have very harmful towards other groups of people. So no, I understand what he's saying about like, we need to listen to people and have discussions. I agree with that piece. I feel like that's just a part of democracy. Like there are always going to be opposing sides. So you do have to talk about it and come to some kind of agreement. But in this political climate, I don't even think that that is a thing that can really happen. Like you can, some people you can work with. And then there are other people who are just like, there's no point in even talking to them because it's too late. It's too late. So don't agree with him on his views on some things, but I do think that in terms of like having this movie come out now actually is a really good thing. And maybe he doesn't want to see it as like, this is about America. Like he wants to distance himself from that idea. Mm-hmm. Which is true, because it is happening everywhere. But I think that if people read it that way, I don't see a problem with that.
Look, I, like you said, I'm all for a picture, I guess, as kind of a cautionary tale of what could happen. It's like basically what a lot of sci-fi pictures are. A lot of them are like cautionary tales. Like yeah. The amount of movies we've had about, hey, don't trust robotics and AI too much. You know, those kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't agree with the good people on both sides. I do think there are hyper-vigilant, ill-informed, misguided people on both sides. You know, there are people on both sides who take it to the extreme on both fringe sides. I don't think there are actually good people. I do think there are people who are using these kind of devices to manipulate things they want to happen. So those people who are caught in the middle are kind of misguided, but I don't. I mean, we already talking about black stuff, but like, it's for me, it's kind of hard when white people say, oh, there are good people on both sides. You'll say that because a lot of the policies on one side are going to negatively affect you, my boy.
Right.
You know,
right.
So yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's like he's speaking from a place of privilege.
Yeah.
So it's like, you can't, and then, and again, that's another piece of it. It's like, you can't really have these discussions because it's like, you are not affected by these things.
Yeah.
So I would have just left it at, this is something that's happening around the world, so it's important to talk about it. I would have just left it at that. But I think sometimes when you let people talk, whole bunch of other stuff comes up.
Talks too much.
You talk too much. It's just stop. Anyways.
So our last and final story is about The Crow. The original director, Alex Proyas, I hope I'm pronouncing that properly, says the original, the film should remain Brandon Lee's legacy instead of being remade. Those who don't know about The Crow, it was a picture starring Bruce Lee's son, Brandon Lee, who died kind of in an auspicious way, just like his father. And shooting the film, but this remake stars Bill Skarsgård and AFK Twigs. It's weird because the original Crow to me is still considered a cult classic. You know, if you're a guy of a certain age, you know, we just recently had a wrestler by the name of Sting retire, who kind of embodied the aesthetics of The Crow into his wrestling career to great success and adulation. Yeah, and it's a cult classic from like 1994. Like, we don't see us like remaking other movies from the genre. Like, we don't see us remaking like Showgirls and stuff like that. Like, movies that kind of have a cult repertoire or cult reverence. So it's kind of hard for me to understand why they were so adamant for this project. I don't know. And for me, visually, this movie gives me very much Jared Leto Joker vibes based on Bill Skarsgård's makeup in it. So I don't know. I don't expect good things from this movie when it comes out anyway. So.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because it's like the director, Alex, was saying, you know, Brandon Lee died at the end of the filming. And so the film was dedicated to him. And that it should just kind of be respected on the basis of like the star of the movie passed away. And so like, that's their thing to hold on to. And so don't remake this movie basically. So he's been saying a lot of things as like the photos and trailers and stuff have, cause that's like one of the things that sparked the story is that the trailer was disliked so many times on YouTube. And he was like, yeah, I agree with that. Like, don't, this shouldn't have happened. It's already happening, but the first of all, the person who is remaking this is Rupert Sanders. And if you don't know who Rupert Sanders is, he directed Snow White in The Huntsman, I think.
Yeah.
Starring Kristen Stewart, who he went on to have an affair with. Like, that is the same man that we're talking about who is remaking this movie. And the way Bill Skarsgård looks, like, he wanted him to look like a modern day rapper instead of like, I don't trust this man to make a good movie. Like, I don't think that he should have been selected to redirect, to remake this. And also, to your point, I just don't feel like we need a whole bunch of remakes in cinema. Like, I honestly think that Showgirls is ripe for being remade. I feel like if a woman actually directed that movie, it could be good.
Yeah.
So maybe they do that. But in terms of like, you know, you have this movie where the star of the film died. Like, maybe we should just leave that alone. I don't know why they chose to remake this. Maybe do it on stage. I don't know if that makes it better, but I don't know. Yeah. That feels weird to me.
And it's not even just like, yeah, remake bad films. Like, this film was not that bad. And also, even after the death of Brandon Lee, they still continued to franchise. They kind of flipped it in the sequel where somebody else is resurrected as the new Crow, kind of that way. If you're going to do that, and this is not a character that's honestly well known, you can just pick it up as a continuation of the already established franchise. Like, it's not like, let's say, another movie that I would kind of fit for would be good, or maybe not for a revival, would be Queen of the Damned, but that also starred Aaliyah, and that movie was also dedicated in her honor. So that's a hard part to do, but they did. Yeah. And it's also based loosely involved with Interview with a Vampire. Guess what? They remade Interview with a Vampire recently. So there are some projects you can revive and reiterate there, and there are some you can't. So yeah, and it's not like the Crow is like Batman or like Superman or Spider-Man where, oh, I gotta see the latest Crow movie. Like, he's not one of those like comic book characters people are hungering for a new picture for. So it could have just picked up from where the last one left off without fully, you know, remaking it. So.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about what we watched this week. Dale?
I watched a short video essay on people have been kind of talking about the comparisons of Talented Mr. Ripley and Saltburn.
I think I watched this too. Wait, what was the name of it?
I think it was
from Broly.
Yeah.
So good.
I did watch that because I was like, I was watching something else and I was like, Saltburn, Talented Mr. Ripley. I was like, And honestly, I'm surprised I never made that connection. Watching the
How
movie.
How did you not make that connection?
I it wasn't because guess this. What? Because know why I didn't make a connection? Because in my head I had them separated. Yes, you know, Emerald Fennell said she enjoys Patricia Highsmith's work, and probably subconsciously she picked up from it. But I didn't go into it watching like, oh, this is Talented Mr. Ripley, straight up. You know, my head was just not even involved because I like weird shit, so I wasn't thinking Talented Mr. Ripley at the time of watching it. So hey, but yeah, no, I enjoyed her breakdown and her explanation of the themes and elements that do correlate in the project, and also how Saltburn also breaks away from Talented Mr. Ripley as well. I think will be a good litmus test for it when people actually recognize it. Probably will be when the Talented Mr. Ripley show, there's a project coming out.
Yeah.
When people watch that, I think people will start comparing it to once in fully, like everybody will be aware of it more once we see that IP come up again. I'm like, oh, this reminds me of Saltburn. And then the whole back and forth is going to start. So, but yeah.
I said that immediately. As soon as I was watching it, I was like, this is the Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yeah, you did. I know.
Set in 2006. Like, great video essay. That was really good. She's a really good creator. So, yeah, I'm glad I was just excited because I was like, oh, we watched the same thing. Ah. I finished watching The Souvenir by Joanna Hogg. I started it a couple weeks ago and I finally finished it. Crazy. She made it into two parts. And so the first part is based on The first part is based on a relationship between her, the actual director, played by Tilda Swinton's daughter, her and a man who was a drug addict who died. And the second part is about her making her like senior film for her film school. I haven't watched Second Breakfast. I don't know where that's at. If I find it, I'll watch it. But this is one thing I don't understand. How people can be so incredibly personal in films. Like, I don't know if I would ever, I mean, I guess I would, but I want to know like what their thought process is, because she said she started working on this film in the 80s. So like a couple years after the relationship ended. And the way the relationship ended was crazy. Like, I was just like, please get out of this relationship, please. But she never really does. The only reason why it ends is because he dies. So that's crazy and completely traumatic. And so the fact that she was able to, like, a few years later be like, okay, I want to make a movie about this, and then it took her 30 years or something to actually do it, is insane. And then I just don't know how you can be so vulnerable about like something that traumatic that happened to you. I guess it makes sense because like it is a story worth telling. It's just like, I don't know how like her or anybody else makes these incredibly personal, incredibly detailed movies about their own experiences. Like, that takes an enormous amount of courage. So props.
I've drawn like personal elements into like the stories and scripts I've written, but never like full on personal, like in depth, oh, this is really what happened to me. Like, I'll like, oh, this element of the character, trying to think of a person. Oh, you know what? The character I'm writing kind of reminds me of my friend. I'll take this characteristic of my friend and put it in there. Like, when I'm writing the script, I'll like, then everybody has nicknames for their friends that they don't say out loud. And so I was like, oh, this reminds me of this friend. And in the whole script is the nickname I have for the friend in it, so I can keep the character in my mind. But I don't know how a lot of these directors and writers go fully like personal. That's something I don't think I can do, you know. There's a lot of comfort in yourself to do that.
Yeah, a lot of like, what? And really cool though, a really good movie, by the way, just like a really good film, but also like, wow. Yeah. That's amazing. So that's all from us this week. We hope that you all are doing well. Make sure to check out all of our social media, support us if you can, and we will see you guys in the next episode. Bye.
Au revoir.